As promised, here's the conclusion of our conversation with Danny Bonnier.
A couple weeks later, I guess Lisa said, you know, take Troy out of Salvation Army. And, you know, I've told them they should talk to you. And I'm like, okay.
Hi, this is Soraya.
And this is Jeff.
Our podcast is called Paisley Stage, Raspberry, and Rhyme.
A podcast where the two of us play music that we like and share anecdotes and background about the tunes.
We hope you'll join our conversation. And without further ado, agrubiaro.
Let's get groovy.
One day they called me from like a party and, you know, said, hey, you know, we should meet and, you know, play together or something. And I guess on Lisa's recommendation, and they came to my parents' house and we played. And I honestly didn't even know what that was, what we were doing. I didn't know if I thought I was auditioning. I had no idea. And at the end of the rehearsal, Michael was like, so we have a gig on July 23rd, which was like 3 weeks away. And I want to put out a record, an EP in the fall. So I remember that stuff very, very vividly. And I think I have a tape from the first or second rehearsal. And Michael had a song called Visions of Airplane Fares that was sort of like, Love Forever Changes.
Wow.
And we did try to work on it a few times. We went back to it later on. We never could kind of get it down, but it was pretty cool. And so in 3 weeks, I was in Salvation Army. And I, at the first rehearsal, I didn't realize I had joined the band. I was pretty shocked. My favorite LA band without even knowing it. But they were so young, you know, it was one of those things I don't think, you know, yeah, you're in the band. It was sort of like, yeah, we have a gig in 3 weeks. I'm like, okay. And, you know, we played somewhere, like, I don't know, the Golden Bear or something. I can't remember which gig it was, but somewhere like down south in Redondo Beach or something. And they had strobe lights. And I had no idea they used strobe lights. And I actually have epilepsy. And
oh, my gosh.
It's pretty much under control in my life now. But I had no idea we were using strobe lights in our show.
That's so dangerous. That was, yeah.
I think, you know, I got them to remove the strobe lights pretty quickly. And so, yeah, I joined this little combo. And then very early on, I think I said, because they had all these keyboards they used. They were trying to, as a three-piece, to do it on stage. I said, you know, I know a guy who can play keyboards. And I think Lewis said, you know, let's wait 6 months. And I remember saying, well, that's 6 months, we won't have a keyboard player. So I got them to meet Mickey. And he came down and he thought they were really cool, but it was very funny because he was like in he was in a top 40 band doing like, you know, weddings and, you know, bar mitzvahs and stuff. Right. And he's also like unsure, even though he knew me, he would take his keyboards home all the time. And for the first few months he actually joined the band, I remember we played a gig at Club Lingerie and we opened with She Turns to Flowers and the three of us are on stage and Mickey's not there. And we open up, down, 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 down. We start the song, and running from the dressing room, Mickey's tucking in his button-up shirt and on stage about halfway through the first verse. And this was very early. I mean, we probably played, I don't know how many gigs maybe Michael or Lewis would know, but we probably played, you know, I don't know, we might have played about 15 gigs as a three-piece. I mean, he wasn't there day one. So there was a short period where we did play gigs, and it was just the three of us. And we were still Salvation Army. So yeah, that was kind of what happened. You know, I miraculously stumbled into a band I loved, which I think most people could say that doesn't really happen often.
No, no. Speaking of the EP that you guys were recording, so that ended up being Baroque Hoedown.
Yes, Michael just sort of stated that I'm going to record an EP in the fall. And I'm like, okay. I mean, the Salvation Army album was pretty new at that point. You know, this is June of 82. It's not like some real old record, but he's already, you know, gunning to make another record. And I think the second or third rehearsal, we play Cantaloupe Girlfriend and we play Marjorie Tells Me. And the early shows, we play those. And it isn't long before we start doing Sorry. Michael tells me he wants to do that song. And I just started playing the beat I thought we should use, which is not exactly the beat on the record or anything, the Easy Beats record. Those songs came in really quickly. Mickey comes in with I Go Wild.
He's the one
person in the band who had music theory. And for, I think, months, he'd been playing with the riff of The Last Time by the Rolling Stones. So that riff that's in the song, he had sort of taken that riff from The Last Time by the Rolling Stones and sort of tore it apart and put it back together.
Oh,
and
wow.
Then came in one day with it. And then, like, everybody jumped off from that point. But that was... That, like Jet Fighter, are both actually, you know, credit should be where credit's due. They start with Mickey.
Wow.
That is cool.
Which a lot of people maybe don't realize, but those songs certainly are ones that, you know, come about because of Mickey's idea first.
Wow.
I like
that. Hey, so you mentioned with the Cantaloupe Girlfriend, during the solo, there's a strange sound in there that I always thought was some kind of synthesizer or some, you're going for some psychedelic sound, but it's actually not a synthesizer during the solo.
No, it's Diane Benaire.
It's what?
But I have to say, to this day, she won't tell me what she says. So at some point, I'm going to put the 16 track up and just put her track up and figure out what she says. But it's one of the few times she's not someone who spent very much time in the studio with us at all. It happened to be a day she was there, which was actually very rare. And I don't know, it must have been Michael saying, oh, let's put some weird whispering in the middle. And so she goes in and whispers under kind of like layers of all the noise going on.
Wow.
That is so cool.
I'm going to play...
She won't tell me what she says, so I have no idea.
I wonder if she still remembers what she says.
I don't know. She's been mum about it. But I do have the tapes, and I could put it up if I really, really wanted to, and maybe someday I will.
So I'm going to play just that part of the song. So I'm going to play just the solo so we can hear that part. I know we're not going to figure out what she says, but let's just hear.
If you can, that's great. You know?
Let's hear that part.
Right.
Let me see if I can cue it up. So we're just looking for the solo part of With the Cantaloupe Girlfriend with Diane Benaire on Whispering.
Here she comes. She doesn't know we're talking about.
That is so weird. I've heard that song hundreds and hundreds of times, and I always thought it was some kind of synthesizer sound.
It's Diane whispering something, which, you know, to this day, she's never told me.
She's the special secret guest on that track. I like it.
She is. We've had a few weird people play on our records, and she's definitely on that list.
Who? I had no idea. No idea. So then from there you did 16 Tambourines following the EP.
Correct.
And by then you were, of course, called the 3 o'clock. So was Mickey a big part of the writing during the 16 Tambourines?
Well, I mean, he brings in Jet Fighter. I mean, is there any other compositions of his on there? I don't think so. I think it's just that one. But I mean, you know, the way we recreated songs was very much in a communal effort. I mean, Jet Fighter being a perfect example. I mean, Mickey and I were driving to rehearsal at that point. We were rehearsing in Lewis's parents' rumpus room or something. Mickey had a cassette and he said, "Can I play you something?" He was always apprehensive because he always wanted things to be right. He was always nervous, and he played me. He put on a cassette that he had in the car. And it was just him on piano, and it was it was just that. And so he played it for me, and I went, and I instantly went on my legs. I went, and I said, it sounds like Rolling Stones, Between the Buttons, period.
Nice.
And that was just what I did. I don't know. And so we go into the room, and literally he plays that. I play the beat. Lewis had an idea for a chord pattern and played it. And within 2 hours, we had the song.
Wow.
The whole thing was down. And it's on, actually on the Omnivore Hidden World Revealed. It's the hidden track is that day when we learned it. It's the hidden track on there.
No way. Oh my gosh. Wow.
So, but it was a very communal making record with Earl, and it's very different than, there's a squeaky toy going on in the background.
Aww.
Another secret guest. I like it.
Yeah, well, that's, you know, I can't help that one.
We love it. We love it.
So, I mean, you know, we worked very much together. We were very rehearsed. We rehearsed all the time. I mean, I just come from being in bands where we weren't sloppy. You know, it was very much like, let's get stuff down. And Earl was a very key factor in everything. I mean, even in the fact that opening note of Jet Fighter, which is actually a mistake. It's some sort of weird, you know, guitar sound that got made by who knows how. And Earl said, we're leaving that. It wasn't meant to be there. It was just a weird accident.
Wow.
And then, you know, we used lots of percussion and, you know, like, I think on My Own with all, like, the layers of harmonies that kept, we layered and layered and layered and layered. And then I think Earl said something like, you know, it's like 16 tambourines or something, you know, because we put about 34 voices on or something. We just kept that whole ooh la 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 stuff, all of that just kept getting bigger and bigger and noisier and weird. So it was a whole different record. And right before we finished recording, Michael and Lewis called, and we recorded a song called "Around the World," which was on the record. It was actually the first song we learned for 16 Tambourines. We opened up our sets with it, and they said we don't want it on the record. It was like last minute. They wouldn't explain themselves. They just said, we don't. I don't know why. It turned out really good. So we were sort of in a quandary, and we went back, and Earl, and we talked about doing In My Own Time because we played it live. And Earl said, well, the only way you're going to do this cover is if you change it up and put something like horns on it.
Oh.
And so it was Earl's idea to add the horns, kind of give it a kind of like our sweet soul sound.
Nice.
That's what we're doing, I guess. And so that was what happened. But, you know, only years later did Around the World get released, which, you know, should have been on the album, but it didn't. But In My Own Time did. So it was a very fun record to make. And I remember when it came out, I think a lot of people were puzzled by, you know, it was a very warm, non-rocking record. It was much more like acoustic guitars and tap pianos and, you know, more orchestrated, and, you know, it had cellos and violins and horns and, you know, so, you know, it was a real pleasure to make that record.
Yeah, I'd say it's a masterpiece.
Oh, absolutely. Jeff, now that Danny mentioned Around the World, I'd like to hear it. This is a track that Jeff and I both like a lot and we admire a lot.
Absolutely. We love the song.
Around the World. Okay.
Let's play it, Around the World, by the 3 o'clock.
Right.
I want to.
So Mickey's killing it on that organ.
Ridiculous.
Yeah, he's pretty great on that.
So Danny, did I hear a cowbell in that song?
Yeah, it's the one song I think in my whole career I played cowbell on.
That can't be the reason why Lewis and Michael wanted to drop it out, is it?
You know, we never really, it's funny you say that, but we never really got into a conversation why.
Huh.
It's weird because like I said, you know, it was one of those funny things where on a lot of our records, the first song we learned we would open sets with and then it would get dumped. We did that a couple times. And it might have just been like we had been playing that for months because it supersedes everything else on the record. And maybe they just thought, oh, I don't know. And also, it would have been one of the, you know, garagey or noisier songs on the record.
Absolutely.
But I have to say, when we learned Jet Fighter, we had a gig in San Diego. Really shortly after we learned it, we were like, oh, yeah, we got to play it. And we went down and we played it. And then, like, with the song finished and two people went, you know. And it was like, we looked at each other and we were so certain this song was really good. And we're like, nobody applauded. I don't get it. You never know. I mean,
I'm fairly certain I was at that show. If it was at UCSD in the gym...
We certainly played San Diego a lot, and it could have been that gig, but...
I'm pretty sure...
It's understandable. I get it, you know. What people gravitate towards are songs they know. So, you know, if all of a sudden you play something they don't know, it's easy to understand that it doesn't have the same enthusiasm.
Right, right. So speaking of not having the same enthusiasm...
Hold on one second, because Tiger Lily wants me to play with her squeaky toy, and I want to get her out of here.
Okay.
Otherwise, it'll just be weird.
So, Soraya, that show, yeah. I think the first show concert that I went to that wasn't an arena rock show was I saw the 3 o'clock at UCSD.
In a gym.
In a gym, right. And actually, on that show, the band, the 3 o'clock, brought in a brass section. I think they had a trumpet and a saxophone player. So.
And that might have been a little later because I remember we did about a handful of shows and we did use our horn section.
Okay.
I actually think we, around the same time, we played a few shows with general public.
Hmm.
And that might have been a little later, but I don't, you know, it's hard. You know, I do remember though we played like three or four shows and the money was good enough to bring the horn section along.
Nice.
Which was something, it was all like Southern California, but it was like we were actually staying overnight in like San Bernardino or something. I don't remember. So you were segueing into something. I had to stop you because it was squeaky toy.
I was going
to really come up often in a conversation. But.
It always happens.
Yeah.
So I was going to talk about Ever After and Vermillion, the last two 3 o'clock records.
Oh, so we're bypassing Arrive Without Traveling. Okay.
Right. So after Arrive Without Traveling, you...
Because obviously, okay. Sure. Go ahead.
So when you guys reunited recently and you've been playing shows, there aren't any songs off of either one of those records. Is there a reason that's the case?
There isn't a distinct reason. I think that Lewis doesn't play on them. And... I think maybe it's just like one of those things where we just never went there because we always kidded with him that if we ever went to the Philippines that he would have to learn on paper.
Yep.
Because there's some bizarre, weird covers of On Paper in the Philippines, and it was apparently like a K-Rock type hit in the Philippines, which is something we didn't know about for like till 20 years later. But, you know, there's like two or three covers and you can go see guys sitting in their backyard covering it and people and like, you know, it looks like weddings or something playing it. There wasn't really a reason. There wasn't. I think, you know, when we went to learn the sets for like Coachella, we never tried anything from the last two records, but we certainly tried about three or four more songs that we ended up not doing. I remember we did consider even playing Tomorrow. Ooh. And a couple others, and it just, for whatever reason, you know, Michael wasn't happy doing it or something, you know, It might have been like vocal reasons or I didn't like the way it was coming together. But I think we just avoided those because he wasn't on them. And I think we just didn't want to open up that.
That makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah. And also, we have a lot more dissatisfaction about those two as a band.
Mm-hmm.
So they didn't turn out the way that you intended them to turn out?
Neither of them, I think, are Ever After has got moments that certainly I think we were going for. But again, there were problems. And Vermillion is just, you know, it's not the record we wanted to make at all. So, you know, I mean, it doesn't mean there aren't songs on there that were good. But both of them are sort of become problematic in various ways, from my point of view.
Was that because of the label or the producer?
With Ever After, we originally were going to record with Jeff Emmerich, who just passed away, the Beatles engineer.
Yes.
And we were going to do it with him. The funny thing was, he didn't like Warm Aspirations.
Oh.
And that wasn't the reason, but he said, like, halfway through, I have to stop and finish an Art Garfunkel record. And we were on a fairly tight schedule. And then we ended up going with Ian Brody, who I had become friends with. And we got Ian to produce it. But we had changed guitar players one of the many times. And our guitarist was really good at playing stuff that already existed, but he didn't sort of have that creative spark that could sort of easily just, you know, run off good ideas.
So that was Steve, correct?
That was Steve. A nice fellow, but it was, you know, it just didn't really work. I think if we'd made the record with Ian Brody playing all the guitars, Ian Brody plays on some of the record. He plays all the, on Susie's On the Ball, he does all that. There's this really fast guitar thing. There's a really fast guitar thing going on. Ian plays that.
Oh, wow.
And he does all that big, those big acoustic guitars on Warm Aspirations. That's him, because that's sort of his wheelhouse.
Nice.
So we had him play on a couple things, so we just like automatically knew he could do it. And he's a great guy. But I think he sort of came in a little confused because the record, without really a strong guitar presence, became more of a keyboard present record. So he was sort of a little confused about what to make. So some of it, like, you know, Warm Aspirations and like the cover of the song Step Out of Line, I think those are more definitely where we were and probably the record we kind of wanted to make. And then I think in some cases we were just hindered a bit by the way we put it together and the way it ended up, you know, being created as a record. It was just a little problematic. And also, you just get beat down. I mean, Arrive Without Traveling was, you know, was a very easy record to make. And so when you kind of move on and then things are a little bit more difficult, you sort of get a little tired. And I think that was the problem with that. And Vermillion, it's just, you know, in all these cases, we always wanted to work with Earl Mankey, but nobody would let us.
Oh.
Oh, it's the guy who's got a studio in his house. It was always that sort of thing. It wasn't a cool thing. It was like, oh, even though that was what got us our first record deal, it's the guy who recorded in the house that got us, you know, that made the record that got us, you know, where we were. So with Vermillion, we ended up just picking a producer that seemed to be the best of the lot. And we recorded in Woodland Hills, this really great studio. We were all set up. And he was just a guy who wanted to make a record based on programming. Okay. And it's just a really weird record. I mean, the funnest day we had in the studio was one day we all got on our instruments and we did a cover of a Burt Bacharach, Hal David song that called Make It Easy on Yourself that the Walker Brothers do. So Jason sings it doing Scott Walker in this very kind of deep deep voice. We did that in Ticket to Ride. And we just were having a blast. And the engineer was this great guy named Chris Sheldon, who we adored and we became really friendly with. And now there were moments. But, you know, all of us were sort of dismayed. But we were so, like, confused as to what we should do. I mean, we should have fired him on day one, but we were just... too beaten down.
Yeah.
So we didn't make the, you know, we went in one, we were set up with guitar, bass, drums, all these ideas of what we were going to do. And it was just blown out of the water.
Wow.
And you know, Michael at that point was really, he was just like, whatever you want me to do, I'll do it sort of thing. And that was kind of, I think, how we all felt.
Kind of phoning it in at that point.
Pardon me?
Kind of phoning it in at that point.
Well, not so much that we were phoning it in, but it was sort of like, it was harder to, battle the forces that that were brought in front of us. I think if it had been, you know, day one of Arrive Without Traveling, you know, three records earlier, we would have said, wait a minute, no, this isn't working. But I think we were so surprised that we were offered another record deal. And I think that, you know, going in and having it being an uncomfortable situation, I think all of us were just like, you know, Jason was really young. He made Michael seem old at that point, which is funny to say, but, you know, and we were all very gung-ho to go in and make this record. And then sort of it turned into this weird thing, and we ended up cutting more songs that didn't get released. That record's got all these weird songs that never even came out. You know, so it's an odd record, and it sort of got brought down by that. I do recall also when we did the song To Be Where You Are Tonight, that all the percussion, all of us got to kind of, the four of us went in the studio and got to bang on all sorts of weird things. But it wasn't really a pleasant experience. The only fun, Jason and I had a video camera, and we videoed like tons of weird stuff. Which someday maybe you'll see the light of day, because that was probably the funnest thing that we did in the studio. But it was. I don't think anybody was having a blast. I don't mean to, you know, get all sad, but, you know,
no.
I mean, I'm you know, look, I'm also realistic. I look at it and I can deal with that. It's just the way things were, and I also feel that the fact that we did reform and we did a lot of things we hadn't done before, you know, was sort of like a do-over. So I think a lot of the things we did in the various times we've gotten in the same room have been a bit different, you know. So, you know, I'm okay with it. You know, you can't reverse what's happened. And we have been able to kind of do a few things like this new project, which certainly was a lot of fun.
So, you know, now that we're kind of coming full circle, one thing you mentioned, Danny, at the beginning, and I'd like you to just elaborate on. So when you talk about Paisley Underground, you talk about that LA music scene and that there were about 4 to 6 bands that were part of this group. So we've got 4 of them on this album coming out soon. Who are the other 2?
Well, I mean, you know, I'm not the rule maker on this, for sure. I think what started... I did live it, yes, absolutely. I do believe one of the things that sort of started sitting with me uncomfortably was very early on, the UK press got enamored by the scene and started just making it that, you know, any band anywhere was part of this. And it was just sort of like, no, it wasn't. It really is just, it's like if, you know, 4 people went to dinner and then, you know, some people you said hello to once said, well, how come I'm not at that dinner? It was sort of an odd thing to me that as time went on very quickly, it was like, oh, the Paisley Underground, you could be from Auckland, New Zealand and be part of it. And also then journalists tried to turn it into a sound.
Like a genre, right? Yeah.
Sound. It was like, you know, the 4 of us and, you know, Long Riders and Green on Red, probably begrudgingly, I think they would probably, you know, rather hang themselves than be tied to that. It'd be True West because they actually kind of played a lot of gigs in that world. But really, you sort of get past that, and it's just like, it's not about that you played in 82 and 83 and 84, whatever,
right,
on a bill with one of these bands. It was more like when we played together, you know, the late Will Glenn would get up and play violin, or the Bangles would get up and sing harmonies, or, you know, Michael would get up and sing with the Bangles, or any of these combinations. And we would hang out together, and Lewis and Sue were a couple. And, you know, it was very much a small knit group of people. I mean, we did a trip up north with Dream Syndicate, and it was a lot of fun. And I remember at one point they had like a white station wagon, and we had a van, and we did this. Okay, half of us are switching. So it was like a Dream O'Clock and a Syndicate 3, you know, traveling together because we were going to the same places.
Right.
And, you know, we got along. I mean, it was just, it was early and there was no reason not to get along. And, you know, there was no ego at that point. And I think it was really more about the communal thing. It was all of us kind of coming, you know, influence-wise from sort of the same ballpark. But all of us were doing something certainly different, you know. And but I think over the, you know, the trillion years that have gone by from the prehistoric age, I just sort of got a little dismayed that, you know, everybody and anybody was part of this, not even seeing this sound. And I don't know, it's just how it sat with me. It doesn't mean anybody else feels exactly the same way. It's just sort of my personal opinion. And right. And I certainly think if you played one gig with Dream Syndicate, it means that you were part of that LA scene, but it doesn't necessarily mean you were part of this tiny little community.
Right.
I mean, Rainy Day is the first example of that. Like, who's on that?
Right.
You know, it wasn't some band from Auckland, New Zealand. And then if you look at, you know, our first couple records, well, who plays on it? You know, on Feel a Lot Better, we have David Roback on the first two records. We have Will Glenn. I mean, it's very much, you know, how these things sort of played out was these people played on each other's records or got up and jammed with us. I mean, I remember, you know, various gigs where this happened. So it doesn't make me angry in absolutely any way. I just am someone who, like, I like history to sort of be at least remotely right.
Right.
Yeah. And I sort of hope that this record, if it does anything 3x4, it rewrites history to the actual fact of what it was. And that's all I can hope for, in the very least, that people go, oh, I get it. It was this little community of musicians that played together.
Yeah. So to me, it sounds like it was a moniker for a group of friends.
Right.
And look, when Michael, I'm the one witness other than the journalist. I'm the one witness at that, when Michael blurts out Pays the Underground, he thinks it's a one-time.
Yep.
He's saying it one time. He had never mentioned that phrase before. He never mentioned it after that. It was like he says it, it goes into the LA Weekly, and then boom, and journalists pick it up and turn it into something. It was just like him saying something. Using that instead of like, oh, you know, this group of bands that are hanging out together.
Mm-hmm.
That was kind of it. But certainly I only say it because I want to right the wrong. And I know you guys get that.
Yep.
But people in other, you know, right. I see all over the place, you know, what the Pains of the Underground supposedly is. And it really makes me laugh. And I remember like when we reformed and people were talking about when we were doing the gig, and these bands started arguing why they weren't playing. And I have to tell you, they were bands that never even played a gig with any of us. Wow. And I was like, what do you want to be part of something that you weren't? I wouldn't.
No, yeah.
It's like a London band saying, you know, in 1963, I'm a Merseybeat band. But you're in London.
By definition, you're not part of it.
Exactly. You know, so yeah, I mean, that's sort of my beef about it. But, you know, I mean it all in jest, and you know, I'm not angry or serious and, you know, taking it to the mat. I like that you brought it up because it is one of those things that I know you guys get.
Yep, absolutely. So we're really excited about this new release, and we've taken a lot of your time, and we really appreciate you being on the show, but we did want to emphasize a few things before we close out, and
sure.
One of them is this project. So it's coming out on limited release. It's called 3x4. It's the Bangles, the 3 O'Clock, the Dream Syndicate, and Rain Parade. This is coming out on Black Friday for the limited release, right, on vinyl and compact disc and also digital release. And in January, I understand there's going to be a full release. But I encourage all of our listeners, please go to your local record store for Black Friday. Pick this up. I did want to go over the track listing real quick.
Sure. And I wanted to mention a couple things while we go over it as well. So, yeah, okay. Please do.
Great. So I'll just read off the CD track listing. That's what I'm aware of. So it opens with the 3 o'clock doing the Bengals Getting Out of Hand, like you mentioned, Danny. Then the Bengals doing That's What You Always Say, which is a Dream Syndicate track. Dream Syndicate doing Rain Parade's You Are My Friend. Rain Parade doing the 3 o'clock's As Real with Danny on percussion. Also, we have the 3 o'clock doing Dream Syndicate's Tell Me When It's Over. Rain Parade doing When You Smile by the Dream Syndicate. The Bengals doing Talking in My Sleep. That's a Rain Parade track. The Dream Syndicate doing Hero Takes a Fall by the Bengals, which I find really interesting. I can't wait to hear that.
Yeah.
The Bengals doing the 3 o'clock's Jet Fighter, which we heard earlier in the show. Rain Parade doing the Bengals' Real World. The 3 o'clock doing Rain Parade's What She's Done to Your Mind. And I
can mention that Sue Hoff's sings harmonies on that.
Wow. Ooh. Wow.
Nice.
And then the closing track is the Dream Syndicate's or the Dream Syndicate doing Salvation Army's She Turns to Flowers. So I am
right.
So excited for this release. I'm going to be camping out for Black Friday.
Thanks. I wanted to mention a couple of unique things about it, just so while we're on the subject. The vinyl for Record Store Day, I believe, is colored vinyl. But also, we had nothing to do with the track order. So nobody involved had anything to do with it. It was a label. But I believe Lewis came up with this idea. The album, the vinyl, is side B, side D, side, where are we? R and side T.
What?
So, yes, not A, B, C, D. So side B is the three Bengals covers. Not the Bengals songs, like the Bengals, what the Bengals are playing. It's a three Bengal covers.
Wow.
So side R is the three Rain Parade covers. Side, you know, so everyone is molded differently. So the track order is completely different.
I love that idea.
There's something different on our track on vinyl and on CD.
Oh,
on one tracks.
Okay, it's a different version, or something's different about it.
It's a different version.
Because
we're sneaky.
Wow.
We got sneaky.
So we need all three.
Yes.
You need none if you don't want them. But,
no, we want them.
I do actually like the fact that I was involved a lot, so I did have the test pressing, and it is got this uniqueness to the record that, you know, side B is just all the three other bands doing the Bengals songs. You know, so it's got this, you know, it's not the Bengals, it's us doing the Bengals, you know, the three bands. So it's got that uniqueness to it that doesn't flow the same way that the CD does.
Wow.
So, and the artwork is by the very talented Phil Smee, who actually did the, I got him to do this. He did our, the Paisley Underground gigs in 2013. He did the poster and the shirt. And, you know, it was one of those things where we brought up like what we should do. And then I mentioned this and I went to Phil, and like Phil was, he lives in England, and he does a lot of art direction on huge, like huge packages, and big fan of this stuff, and got him to do the artwork. So I'm very excited that he did the cover, and I'm a big fan of his work. So that was a big deal to me.
The artwork looks amazing.
Yes.
All right.
Danny, are there any plans for live shows? I know people have been asking you, but...
You know, I can say, really, down to this very moment, you know, we're attempting to try to do something at some point. There are just a lot of... there are a lot of reasons, you know. It'll be like, well, we can't because Dream Syndicate are in Europe, or we can't because something else. So far... We haven't been able to figure out a way to make something happen. But I have to say, it's the most difficult part about this. Making the record with the four groups was actually, even though there were a lot of emails and where everybody was involved, it was one of the easier parts to do. Getting four bands to all get on the same page about playing is a lot harder because everybody's got things going on in their life.
Right.
As I started saying, it's tough being a band when you're not a band, but you are a band. And that's sort of my slogan for what we do.
Makes sense.
Yeah, so I mean, hopefully, I would hope and I would imagine, you know, sometime if something happens, hopefully in the first quarter of next year, something would happen. But I there's nothing at this moment, absolutely nothing. But we're attempting all kinds of things, interviews and various other things. We'll see how it all fleshes out.
Fantastic. Well, Black Friday.
Yes, Black Friday. And
there might be something to add to that, but I can't tell you right now. So we'll something to tell you about Black Friday, but I just can't say it yet.
All right. So everybody, make sure that you follow the 3 o'clock's Facebook page, I would imagine.
And Twitter. And Instagram.
It will come up. And if I do know for sure, I will let you both know so you'll be aware.
Thank you so much.
There might be something that on Black Friday. So.
Excellent.
Okay.
But no performing. I'm putting it out there right now. No performing.
Okay.
Might happen. I'm just saying.
Very good. Thank you so much. So I think I was going to say, I think we would be remiss if we didn't mention that one of the Paisley Underground bands, the Dream Syndicate, is going on a short tour. They will be playing 5 shows here coming up. So if you're in any of these areas, please check them out. On October 16th, they'll be playing the Wonder Ballroom in Portland, Oregon. October 17th, the Neptune Theater in Seattle, Washington. October 19th, the Fillmore in San Francisco. October 20th, at Harlow's in Sacramento. And their last show will be October 21st at the Fonda Theater in Los Angeles. You'll find me there. After that, I understand that Steve Wynn will be doing some solo shows in Europe, so he's going to be leaving after that. And I did want to mention one last thing, and that's that Michael Quercio's post 3 o'clock band, Permanent Green Light, has a compilation coming out on Omnivore Records, and it's going to be called Hallucinations. That comes out October 19th, so make sure you pick that up. It's going to be amazing. I'm super excited for that.
Yeah.
And that's all that we have for news. And Danny, we're so excited that you joined us on the podcast, and we really appreciate you taking all this time to
talk
to us.
Thank you so much. This is really a treat.
Oh, thank you both so much. It was my pleasure.
And
before we sign up, I want to thank Diane Benair and Tiger Lily for contributing to today's show.
Absolutely.
Along the way, I appreciate it so much.
They'll both say thank you back if they only knew. Poppy didn't do anything, so you didn't hear her. But I'm looking
thank
at
Poppy
her
too.
Yeah, well, you know, she's okay with it.
Well, Danny, we really appreciate it, and we thank you so much for joining as a guest on the show.
Thank you, and take care.
Okay.
Have a good weekend.
All right. Bye bye. All right, Soraya, I will talk to you later.
Awesome. Thanks, everybody. Agro we are.
Groove on, Paisley people.